These I find non-dull and interesting. I am still looking for a single counterexample, a non-dull activity that belongs to Mediocristan. Acknowledging the role of this concentration of success and acting accordingly causes us to be punished twice. We live in a society where the reward mechanism is based on the illusion of the regular. Our hormonal reward system also needs tangible and steady results. It too thinks that the world is steady and well-behaved. It falls for the confirmation error. The world has changed too fast for our genetic makeup. We are alienated from our environment. Peer cruelty. Every morning you leave your cramped apartment in Manhattan's East Village to go to your laboratory at the Rockefeller University in the East 60s. You return in the late evening, and people in your social network ask you if you had a good day, just to be polite. At the laboratory, people are more tactful. Of course you did not have a good day. You found nothing. You are not a watch repairman. Your finding nothing is very valuable, since it is part of the process of discovery. Hey, you know where not to look. Other researchers, knowing your results, would avoid trying your special experiment, provided a journal is thoughtful enough to consider your found nothing as information and publish it. Meanwhile, your brother-in-law is a salesman for a Wall Street firm and keeps getting large commissions, large and steady commissions. He is doing very well, you hear, particularly from your father-in-law, with a small, pensive nanosecond of silence after the utterance, which makes you realize that he just made a comparison. It was involuntary, but he made one. Holidays can be terrible. You run into your brother-in-law at family reunions and, invariably, detect unmistakable signs of frustration on the part of your wife, who, briefly, fears that she married a loser, before remembering the logic of your profession. But she has to fight her first impulse. Her sister will not stop talking about their renovations, their new wallpaper. Your wife will be a little more silent than usual on the drive home. This sulking will be made slightly worse because the car you are driving is rented, since you cannot afford to garage a car in Manhattan. What should you do? Move to Australia and thereby make family reunions less frequent? Or switch brothers-in-law by marrying someone with a less successful brother? Or should you dress like a hippie and become defiant? That may work for an artist, but not so easily for a scientist or a businessman. You are trapped. You work on a project that does not deliver immediate or steady results. All the while, people around you work on projects that do. You are in trouble. Such is the lot of scientists, artists, and researchers lost in society rather than living in an insulated community or an artist colony. Positive lumpy outcomes, for which we either collect big or get nothing, prevail in numerous occupations. Those invested with a sense of mission, such as doggedly pursuing, in a smelly laboratory, the elusive cure for cancer, writing a book that will change the way people view the world while living hand-to-mouth, making music, or painting miniature icons on subway trains and considering it a higher form of art despite the diatribes of the antiquated scholar Harold Bloom. If you are a researcher, you will have to publish inconsequential articles in prestigious publications so that others say hello to you once in a while when you run into them at conferences. If you run a public corporation, things were great for you before you had shareholders, when you and your partners were the sole owners, along with savvy venture capitalists who understood uneven results and the lumpy nature of economic life. But now you have a slow-thinking 30-year-old security analyst at a downtown Manhattan firm who judges your results and reads too much into them. He likes routine rewards, and the last thing you can deliver are routine rewards. Many people labor in life under the impression that they are doing something right, yet they may not show solid results for a long time. They need a capacity for continuously adjourned gratification to survive a steady diet of peer cruelty without becoming demoralized. They look like idiots to their cousins. They look like idiots to their peers. They need courage to continue. No confirmation comes to them, no validation, no fawning students, no Nobel, no Schnobel. How was your year? Brings them a small but containable spasm of pain deep inside. since almost all of their years will seem wasted to someone looking at their life from the outside. Then bang, the lumpy event comes that brings the grand vindication. Or it may never come. Believe me, it is tough to deal with the social consequences of the appearance of continuous failure. We are social animals. Hell is other people. Where the relevant is the sensational. Our intuitions are not cut out for non-linearities. Consider our life in a primitive environment where process and result are closely connected. You are thirsty. Drinking brings you adequate satisfaction. Or even in a not-so-primitive environment, when you engage in building, say, a bridge or a stone house, more work will lead to more apparent results, so your mood is propped up by visible continuous feedback. In a primitive environment, the relevant is the sensational. This applies to our knowledge. When we try to collect information about the world around us, we tend to be guided by our biology, and our attention flows effortlessly toward the sensational. Not the relevant so much as the sensational. Somehow the guidance system has gone wrong in the process of our co-evolution with our habitat. It was transplanted into a world in which the relevant is often boring, non-sensational. Furthermore, we think that if, say, two variables are causally linked, then a steady input in one variable should always yield a result in the other one. Our emotional apparatus is designed for linear causality. For instance, if you study every day, you expect to learn something in proportion to your studies. If you feel that you are not going anywhere, your emotions will cause you to become demoralized. But modern reality rarely gives us the privilege of a satisfying, linear, positive progression. You may think about a problem for a year and learn nothing. Then, unless you are disheartened by the emptiness of the results and give up, something will come to you in a flash. Researchers spent some time dealing with this notion of gratification. Neurology has been enlightening us about the tension between the notions of immediate rewards and delayed ones. Would you like a massage today or two next week? Well, the news is that the logical part of our mind, that higher one, which distinguishes us from animals, can override our animal instincts, which asks for immediate rewards. So we are a little better than animals after all. But perhaps not by much, and not all of the time. Non-linearities. The situation can get a little more tragic. The world is more non-linear than we think, and than scientists would like to think. With linearities, relationships between variables are clear, crisp, and constant, therefore platonically easy to grasp in a single sentence, such as, a 10% increase in money in the bank corresponds to a 10% increase in interest income and a 5% increase in obsequiousness on the part of the personal banker. If you have more money in the bank, you get more interest. Nonlinear relationships can vary. Perhaps the best way to describe them is to say that they cannot be expressed verbally in a way that does justice to them. Take the relationship between pleasure and drinking water. If you are in a state of painful thirst, then a bottle of water increases your well-being significantly. More water means more pleasure. But what if I gave you a cistern of water? Clearly, your well-being becomes rapidly insensitive to further quantities. As a matter of fact, if I gave you the choice between a bottle or a cistern, you would prefer the bottle. So your enjoyment declines with additional quantities. These nonlinear relationships are ubiquitous in life. Linear relationships are truly the exception. We only focus on them in classrooms and textbooks because they are easier to understand. Yesterday afternoon, I tried to take a fresh look around me to catalog what I could see during my day that was linear. I could not find anything. No more than someone hunting for squares or triangles could find them in the rainforest, or, as we will see in part 3, any more than someone looking for bell-shaped randomness finding it in socioeconomic phenomena. You play tennis every day with no improvement, then suddenly you start beating the pro. Your child does not seem to have a learning impediment, but he does not seem to want to speak. The schoolmaster pressures you to start considering other options, namely therapy. You argue with her to no avail. She is supposed to be the expert. Then suddenly the child starts composing elaborate sentences, perhaps a bit too elaborate for his age group. I will repeat that linear progression, a Platonic idea, is not the norm. Process over results. We favor the sensational and the extremely visible. This affects the way we judge heroes. There is little room in our consciousness for heroes who do not deliver visible results, or those heroes who focus on process rather than results. However, those who claim that they value process over result are not telling the whole truth, assuming, of course, that they are members of the human species. We often hear the semi-lie that writers do not write for glory, that artists create for the sake of art, because the activity is its own reward. True, these activities can generate a steady flow of auto-satisfaction, but this does not mean that artists do not crave some form of attention, or that they would not be better off if they got some publicity. It does not mean that writers do not wake up early Saturday morning to check if the New York Times Book Review has featured their work, even if it is a very long shot, or that they do not keep checking their mailbox for that long-awaited reply from the New Yorker. Even a philosopher of the caliber of Hume spent a few weeks sick in bed after the trashing of his masterpiece, what later became known as his version of the Black Swan problem, by some dim-thinking reviewer, whom he knew to be wrong and to have missed his whole point. Where it gets painful is when you see one of your peers, whom you despise, heading to Stockholm for his Nobel reception. Most people engaged in the pursuits that I call concentrated spend most of their time waiting for the big day that usually never comes. True, this takes your mind away from the pettiness of life, the cappuccino that is too warm or too cold, the waiter too slow or too intrusive, the food too spicy or not enough, the overpriced hotel room that does not quite resemble the advertised picture. All of these considerations disappear because you have your mind on much bigger and better things. But this does not mean that the person insulated from materialistic pursuits becomes impervious to other pains, those issuing from disrespect. Often these black swan hunters feel shame, or are made to feel shame, at not contributing. You betrayed those who had high hopes for you, they are told, increasing their feeling of guilt. The problem of lumpy payoffs is not so much in the lack of income they entail, but the pecking order, the loss of dignity, the subtle humiliations near the water cooler. It is my great hope someday to see science and decision makers rediscover what the ancients have always known, namely that our highest currency is respect. Even economically, the individual black swan hunters are not the ones who make the bucks. The researcher Thomas Osterbro has shown that returns on independent inventions, you take the cemetery into account, are far lower than those on venture capital. Some blindness to the odds or an obsession with their own positive black swan is necessary for entrepreneurs to function. The venture capitalist is the one who gets the shekels. The economist William Baumol calls this a touch of madness. This may indeed apply to all concentrated businesses. When you look at the empirical record, you not only see that venture capitalists do better than entrepreneurs, but publishers do better than writers, dealers do better than artists, and science does better than scientists. About 50% of scientific and scholarly papers, costing months, sometimes years of effort, are never truly read. The person involved in such gambles is paid in a currency other than material success, hope. Human nature, happiness, and lumpy rewards. Let me distill the main idea behind what researchers call hedonic happiness. Making $1 million in 1 year, but nothing in the preceding 9, does not bring the same pleasure as having the total evenly distributed over the same period, that is, $100,000 every year for 10 years in a row. The same applies to the inverse order, making a bundle the first year, then nothing for the remaining period. Somehow, your pleasure system will be saturated rather quickly, and it will not carry forward the hedonic balance like a sum on a tax return. As a matter of fact, your happiness depends far more on the number of instances of positive feelings, what psychologists call positive affect, than on their intensity when they hit. In other words, good news is good news first. How good matters rather little. So to have a pleasant life, you should spread these small affects across time as evenly as possible. Plenty of mildly good news is preferable to one single lump of great news. Sadly, it may be even worse for you to make $10 million than lose back 9, than to making nothing at all. True, you may end up with a million as compared to nothing, but it may be better had you got zilch. This assumes, of course, that you care about financial rewards. So, from a narrowly defined accounting point of view, which I may call here hedonic calculus, it does not pay to shoot for one large win. Mother Nature destined us to derive enjoyment from a steady flow of pleasant small but frequent rewards. As I said, the rewards do not have to be large, just frequent. A little bit here, a little bit there. Consider that our major satisfaction for thousands of years came in the form of food and water, and something else more private, and that while we need these steadily, we quickly reach saturation. The problem, of course, is that we do not live in an environment where results are delivered in a steady manner. Black swans dominate much of human history. It is unfortunate that the right strategy for our current environment may not offer internal rewards and positive feedback. The same property in reverse applies to our unhappiness. It is better to lump all your pain into a brief period rather than have it spread out over a longer one. But some people find it possible to transcend the asymmetry of pains and joys, escape the hedonic deficit, set themselves outside that game, and live with hope. There is some good news, as we see next. The Antechamber of Hope. For Yevgenia Krasnova, a person could love one book, at most a few. Beyond this was a form of promiscuity. Those who talk about books as commodities are inauthentic, just as those who collect acquaintances can be superficial in their friendships. A novel you like resembles a friend. You read it and reread it, getting to know it better. Like a friend, you accept it the way it is. You do not judge it. Montaigne was asked why he and the writer Étienne de la Boétie were friends, the kind of question people ask you at a cocktail party as if you knew the answer, or as if there were an answer to no. It was typical of Montaigne to reply, "Parce que c'était lui, parce que c'était moi," because it was him and because it was me. Likewise, Yevgenia claims that she likes that one book because it is it and because I am me. Yevgenia once even walked out on a school teacher because he analyzed that book and thus violated her rule. One does not sit idle listening as people wax analytical about your friends. A very stubborn schoolchild she was. This book she has as a friend is Il Deserto dei Tartari by Dino Buzzati, a novel that was well known in Italy and France during her childhood, but that, strangely, nobody she knows in America had heard of. Its English title is mistranslated as The Tartar Steppe, instead of The Desert of the Tartars. Yevgenia encountered Il Deserto when she was 13, in her parents' weekend country house in a small village 200 kilometers outside Paris, where their Russian and French books multiplied without the constraints of the overfed Parisian apartment. She was so bored in the country that she could not even read. Then, one afternoon, she opened the book and was sucked into it. Inebriated by Hope. Giovanni Drogo is a man of promise. He has just graduated from the military academy with the rank of junior officer, and active life is just starting. But things do not turn out as planned. His initial 4-year assignment is a remote outpost, the Bastiani Fortress, protecting the nation from the Tartars likely to invade from the border desert. Not too desirable a position. The fortress is located a few days by horseback from the town. There is nothing but barrenness around it, none of the social buzz that a man of his age could look forward to. Drogo thinks that his assignment in the outpost is temporary, a way for him to pay his dues before more appealing positions present themselves. Later, back in town, in his impeccably ironed uniform and with his athletic figure, few ladies will be able to resist him. What is Drogo to do in this hole? He discovers a loophole, a way to be transferred after only 4 months. He decides to use the loophole. At the very last minute, however, Drogo takes a glance at the desert from the window of the medical office and decides to extend his stay. Something in the walls of the fort and the silent landscape ensnares him. The appeal of the fort and waiting for the attackers, the big battle with the ferocious Tartars, gradually become his only reason to exist. The entire atmosphere of the fort is one of anticipation. The other men spend their time looking at the horizon and awaiting the big event of the enemy attack. They are so focused that, on rare occasions, they can detect the most insignificant stray animal that appears at the edge of the desert and mistake it for an enemy attack. Sure enough, Drogo spends the rest of his life extending his stay, delaying the beginning of his life in the city, 35 years of pure hope spent in the grip of the idea that one day, from the remote hills that no human has ever crossed, the attackers will eventually emerge and help him rise to the occasion. At the end of the novel, we see Drogo dying in a roadside inn as the event for which he has waited all his life takes place. He has missed it. The Sweet Trap of Anticipation. Evgenia read Il Deserto numerous times. She even learned Italian and perhaps married an Italian, so she could read it in the original. Yet she never had the heart to reread the painful ending. I presented the Black Swan as the outlier, the important event that is not expected to happen. But consider the opposite, the unexpected event that you very badly want to happen. Drogo is obsessed and blinded by the possibility of an unlikely event. That rare occurrence is his raison d'être. At 13, when she encountered the book, little did Evgenia know that she would spend an entire life playing Giovanni Drogo in the antechamber of hope, waiting for the big event, sacrificing for it, and refusing intermediate steps, the consolation prizes. She did not mind the sweet trap of anticipation. To her, it was a life worth living. It was worth living in the cathartic simplicity of a single purpose. Indeed, be careful what you wish for. She may have been happier before the black swan of her success than after. One of the attributes of a black swan is an asymmetry in consequences, either positive or negative. For Drogo, the consequences were 35 years spent waiting in the antechamber of hope for just a few randomly distributed hours of glory, which he ended up missing. When you need the Bastiani fortress. Note that there was no brother-in-law around in Drogo's social network. He was lucky to have companions in his mission. He was a member of a community at the gate of the desert, intently looking together at the horizon. Drogo had the advantage of an association with peers and the avoidance of social contact with others outside the community. We are local animals, interested in our immediate neighborhood, even if people far away consider us total idiots. Those Homo sapiens are abstract and remote, and we do not care about them because we do not run into them in elevators or make eye contact with them. Our shallowness can sometimes work for us. It may be a banality that we need others for many things, but we need them far more than we realize, particularly for dignity and respect. Indeed, we have very few historical records of people who have achieved anything extraordinary without such peer validation, but we have the freedom to choose our peers. If we look at the history of ideas, we see schools of thought occasionally forming, producing unusual work, unpopular outside the school. You hear about the Stoics, the academic skeptics, the cynics, the Pyrrhonian skeptics, the Essenes, the surrealists, the Dadaists, the anarchists, the hippies, the fundamentalists. A school allows someone with unusual ideas with the remote possibility of a payoff to find company and create a microcosm insulated from others. The members of the group can be ostracized together, which is better than being ostracized alone. If you engage in a black swan-dependent activity, it is better to be part of a group. El Desierto de los Tartaros. Evgenia met Nero Tulip in the lobby of the Hotel Danieli in Venice. He was a trader who lived between London and New York. At the time, traders from London went to Venice on Friday noon during the low season, just to talk to other traders from London. As Evgenia and Nero stood engaged in an effortless conversation, she noticed that her husband was looking uncomfortably at them from the bar where he sat, trying to stay focused on the pontifications of one of his childhood friends. Evgenia realized that she was going to see a bit more of Nero. They met again in New York, first in a clandestine way. Her husband, being a philosophy professor, had too much time on his hands, so he started paying close attention to her schedule and became clingy. The clingier he got, the more stifled Evgenia felt, which made him even clingier. She dumped him, called her lawyer who was by then expecting to hear from her, and saw more of Nero openly. Nero had a stiff gait since he was recovering from a helicopter crash. He gets a little too arrogant after episodes of success and starts taking uncalculated physical risks, though he remains financially hyper-conservative, even paranoid. He had spent several months immobile in a London hospital, hardly able to read or write, trying to resist having to watch television, teasing the nurses, and waiting for his bones to heal. He can draw the ceiling with its 14 cracks from memory, as well as the shabby white building across the street with its 63 window panes, all in need of professional cleaning. Nero claimed that he was comfortable in Italian when he drank, so Evgenia gave him a copy of Il Deserto. Nero did not read novels. Novels are fun to write, not read, he claimed. So he left the book by his bedside for a while. Nero and Evgenia were, in a sense, like night and day. Evgenia went to bed at dawn, working on her manuscripts at night. Nero rose at dawn, like most traders, even on weekends. He then worked for an hour on his opus, Treatise on Probability, and never touched it again after that. He had been writing it for a decade and felt rushed to finish it only when his life was threatened. Evgenia smoked. Nero was mindful of his health, spending at least an hour a day at the gym or in the pool. Evgenia hung around intellectuals and bohemians. Nero often felt comfortable with street-smart traders and businessmen who had never been to college and spoke with cripplingly severe Brooklyn accents. Evgenia never understood how a classicist and a polyglot like Nero could socialize with people like that. What was worse, she had this French Fifth Republic overt disdain for money, unless disguised by an intellectual or cultural facade, and she could hardly bear these Brooklyn fellows with thick, hairy fingers and gigantic bank accounts. Nero's post-Brooklyn friends, in turn, found her snotty. One of the effects of prosperity has been a steady migration of streetwise people from Brooklyn to Staten Island and New Jersey. Nero was also elitist, unbearably so, but in a different way. He separated those who could connect the dots, Brooklyn-born or not, from those who could not, regardless of their levels of sophistication and learning. A few months later, after he was done with Evgenia, with inordinate relief, he opened Il Deserto and was sucked into it. Evgenia had the prescience that, like her, Nero would identify with Giovanni Drogo, the main character of Il Deserto. He did. Nero, in turn, bought cases of the English bad translation of the book and handed copies to anyone who said a polite hello to him, including his New York doorman who could hardly speak English, let alone read it. Nero was so enthusiastic while explaining the story that the doorman got interested and Nero had to order the Spanish translation for him. El desierto de los tártaros. Bleed or blow up. Let us separate the world into two categories. Some people are like the turkey, exposed to a major blow up without being aware of it, while others play reverse turkey, prepared for big events that might surprise others. In some strategies and life situations, you gamble dollars to win a succession of pennies while appearing to be winning all the time. In others, you risk a succession of pennies to win dollars. In other words, you bet either that the black swan will happen or that it will never happen. Two strategies that require completely different mindsets. We have seen that we humans have a marked preference for making a little bit of income at a time. Recall from Chapter 4 that in the summer of 1982, large American banks lost close to everything they had ever earned, and more. So some matters that belong to extremistan are extremely dangerous, but do not appear to be so beforehand, since they hide and delay their risks, so suckers think they are safe. It is indeed a property of Extremistan to look less risky in the short run than it really is. Nero called the businesses exposed to such blow-ups dubious businesses, particularly since he distrusted whatever method was being used to compute the odds of a blow-up. Recall from Chapter 4 that the accounting period upon which companies' performances are evaluated is too short to reveal whether or not they are doing a great job, and, owing to the shallowness of our intuitions, we formulate our risk assessments too quickly. I will rapidly present Nero's idea. His premise was the following trivial point. Some business bets in which one wins big but infrequently, yet loses small but frequently, are worth making if others are suckers for them, and if you have the personal and intellectual stamina. But you need such stamina. You also need to deal with people in your entourage heaping all manner of insult on you, much of it blatant. People often accept that a financial strategy with a small chance of success is not necessarily a bad one, as long as the success is large enough to justify it. For a spate of psychological reasons, however, people have difficulty carrying out such a strategy, simply because it requires a combination of belief, a capacity for delayed gratification, and the willingness to be spat upon by clients without blinking. And those who lose money for any reason start looking like guilty dogs, eliciting more scorn on the part of their entourage. Against that background of potential blow-up disguised as skills, Nero engaged in a strategy that he called bleed. You lose steadily, daily, for a long time, except when some event takes place for which you get paid disproportionately well. No single event can make you blow up, on the other hand. Some changes in the world can produce extraordinarily large profits that pay back such bleed for years, sometimes decades, sometimes even centuries. Of all the people he knew, Nero was the least genetically designed for such a strategy. His brain disagreed so heavily with his body that he found himself in a state of continuous warfare. It was his body that was the problem, which accumulated physical fatigue from the neurobiological effect of exposure to the small continuous losses, Chinese water torture style, throughout the day. Nero discovered that the losses went to his emotional brain, bypassing his higher cortical structures and slowly affecting his hippocampus and weakening his memory. The hippocampus is the structure where memory is supposedly controlled. It is the most plastic part of the brain. It is also the part that is assumed to absorb all the damage from repeated insults like the chronic stress we experience daily from small doses of negative feelings, as opposed to the invigorating good stress of the tiger popping up occasionally in your living room. You can rationalize all you want. The hippocampus takes the insult of chronic stress seriously, incurring irreversible atrophy. Contrary to popular belief, these small, seemingly harmless stressors do not strengthen you. They can amputate part of yourself. It was the exposure to a high level of information that poisoned Nero's life. He could sustain the pain if he saw only weekly performance numbers instead of updates every minute. He did better emotionally with his own portfolio than with those of clients, since he was not obligated to monitor it continuously. If his neurobiological system was a victim of the confirmation bias, reacting to the short term and the visible, he could trick his brain to escape its vicious effect by focusing only on the longer haul. He refused to look at any printout of his track record that was shorter than 10 years. Nero came of age, intellectually speaking, with the stock market crash of 1987, in which he derived monstrous returns on what small equity he controlled. This episode would forever make his track record valuable, taken as a whole. In close to 20 years of trading, Nero had only 4 good years. For him, one was more than enough. All he needed was one good year per century. Investors were no problem for him. They needed his trading as insurance and paid him well. He just had to exhibit a mild degree of contempt toward those he wanted to shed, which did not take much effort on his part. This effort was not contrived. Nero did not think much of them and let his body language express it freely, all the while maintaining an unfashionably high level of courtesy. He made sure, after a long string of losses, that they did not think he was apologetic. Indeed, paradoxically, they became more supportive that way. Humans will believe anything you say, provided you do not exhibit the smallest shadow of diffidence. Like animals, they can detect the smallest crack in your confidence before you express it. The trick is to be as smooth as possible in personal manners. It is much easier to signal self-confidence if you are exceedingly polite and friendly. You can control people without having to offend their sensitivity. The problem with business people, Nero realized, is that if you act like a loser, they will treat you as a loser. You set the yardstick yourself. There is no absolute measure of good or bad. It is not what you are telling people. It is how you are saying it. But you need to remain understated and maintain an Olympian calm in front of others. When he worked as a trader for an investment bank, Nero had to face the typical employee evaluation form. The form was supposed to keep track of performance, supposedly as a check against employees slacking off. Nero found the evaluation absurd because it did not so much judge the quality of a trader's performance as encourage him to game the system by working for short-term profits at the expense of possible blow-ups, like banks that give foolish loans that have a small probability of blowing up because the loan officer is shooting for his next quarterly evaluation. So one day early in his career, Nero sat down and listened very calmly to the evaluation of his supervisor. When Nero was handed the evaluation form, he tore it into small pieces in front of him. He did this very slowly, accentuating the contrast between the nature of the act and the tranquility with which he tore the paper. The boss watched him, blank with fear, eyes popping out of his head. Nero focused on his undramatic, slow-motion act, elated by both the feeling of standing up for his beliefs and the aesthetics of its execution. The combination of elegance and dignity was exhilarating. He knew that he would either be fired or left alone. He was left alone. Chapter 8. Giacomo Casanova's Unfailing Luck, The Problem of Silent Evidence. The Diagoras Problem, How Black Swans Make Their Way Out of History Books. Methods to Help You Avoid Drowning. The drowned do not usually vote. We should all be stockbrokers. Do silent witnesses count? Casanova's Etoile. New York is so invincible. Another fallacy in the way we understand events is that of silent evidence. History hides both black swans and its black swan-generating ability from us. The Story of the Drowned Worshippers. More than 2,000 years ago, the Roman orator, belletrist, thinker, stoic, manipulator, politician, and usually virtuous gentleman, Marcus Tullius Cicero, presented the following story. One Diagoras, a non-believer in the gods, was shown painted tablets bearing the portraits of some worshippers who prayed, then survived a subsequent shipwreck. The implication was that praying protects you from drowning. Diagoras asked, "Where were the pictures of those who prayed, then drowned?" The drowned worshippers, being dead, would have a lot of trouble advertising their experiences from the bottom of the sea. This can fool the casual observer into believing in miracles. We call this the problem of silent evidence. The idea is simple, yet potent and universal. While most thinkers try to put to shame those who came before them, Cicero puts to shame almost all empirical thinkers who came after him until very recently. Later on, both my hero of heroes, the essayist Michel de Montaigne and the empirical Francis Bacon, mentioned the point in their works, applying it to the formation of false beliefs. And such is the way of all superstition, whether in astrology, dreams, omens, divine judgments, or the like, wrote Bacon in his Novum Organum. The problem, of course, is that unless they are drilled into us systematically or integrated into our way of thinking, these great observations are rapidly forgotten. Silent evidence pervades everything connected to the notion of history. By history, I don't just mean those learned but dull books in the history section. with Renaissance paintings on their cover to attract buyers. History, I will repeat, is any succession of events seen with the effect of posteriority. This bias extends to the ascription of factors in the success of ideas and religions, to the illusion of skill in many professions, to success in artistic occupations, to the nature versus nurture debate, to mistakes in using evidence in the court of law, to illusions about the logic of history, and of course, most severely, in our perception of the nature of extreme events. You are in a classroom listening to someone self-important, dignified, and ponderous, but dull, wearing a tweed jacket, white shirt, polka dot tie, pontificating for 2 hours on the theories of history. You are too paralyzed by boredom to understand what on earth he is talking about, but you hear the names of big guns. Hegel, Fichte, Marx, Proudhon, Plato, Herodotus, Ibn Khaldun, Toynbee, Spengler, Michelet, Carr, Bloch, Fukuyama, Shmukuyama, Trukuyama. He seems deep and knowledgeable, making sure that no attention lapse will make you forget that his approach is post-Marxist, post-dialectical, or post-something, whatever that means. Then you realize that a large part of what he is saying reposes on a simple optical illusion. But this will not make a difference. He is so invested in it that if you questioned his method, he would react by throwing even more names at you. It is so easy to avoid looking at the cemetery while concocting historical theories. But this is not just a problem with history. It is a problem with the way we construct samples and gather evidence in every domain. We shall call this distortion a bias, i.e., the difference between what you see and what is there. By bias, I mean a systematic error consistently showing a more positive or negative effect from the phenomenon, like a scale that unfailingly shows you a few pounds heavier or lighter than your true weight, or a video camera that adds a few sizes to your waistline. This bias has been rediscovered here and there throughout the past century across disciplines, often to be rapidly forgotten, like Cicero's insight. As drowned worshippers do not write histories of their experiences, it is better to be alive for that. So it is with the losers in history, whether people or ideas. Remarkably, historians and other scholars in the humanities who need to understand silent evidence the most do not seem to have a name for it, and I looked hard. As for journalists, forget about it. They are industrial producers of the distortion. The term bias also indicates the condition's potentially quantifiable nature. You may be able to calculate the distortion and to correct for it by taking into account both the dead and the living, instead of only the living. Silent evidence is what events use to conceal their own randomness, particularly the black swan type of randomness. Sir Francis Bacon is an interesting and endearing fellow in many respects. He harbored a deep-seated, skeptical, non-academic, anti-dogmatic, and obsessively empirical nature, which, to someone skeptical, non-academic, anti-dogmatic, and obsessively empirical, like this author, is a quality almost impossible to find in the thinking business. Anyone can be skeptical. Any scientist can be overly empirical. It is the rigor coming from the combination of skepticism and empiricism that's hard to come by. The problem is that his empiricism wanted us to confirm, not disconfirm. Thus, he introduced the problem of confirmation, that beastly corroboration that generates the black swan. The Cemetery of Letters. The Phoenicians, we are often reminded, produced no literature, although they allegedly invented the alphabet. Commentators discuss their Philistinism from the bias of this absence of a written legacy, asserting that by race or culture, they were more interested in commerce than in the arts. Accordingly, the Phoenician invention of the alphabet served the lower purpose of commercial record-keeping rather than the more noble purpose of literary production. I remember finding on the shelves of a country house I once rented a mildewed book by Will and Ariel Durant describing the Phoenicians as the merchant race. I was tempted to throw it in the fireplace. Well, it now seems that the Phoenicians wrote quite a bit, but using a perishable brand of papyrus that did not stand the biodegradative assaults of time. Manuscripts had a high rate of extinction before copyists and authors switched to parchments in the 2nd or 3rd century. Those not copied during that period simply disappeared. The neglect of silent evidence is endemic to the way we study comparative talent, particularly in activities that are plagued with winner-take-all attributes. We may enjoy what we see, but there is no point reading too much into success stories because we do not see the full picture. Recall the winner-take-all effect from Chapter 3. Notice the large number of people who call themselves writers but are, only temporarily, operating the shiny cappuccino machines at Starbucks. The inequity in this field is larger than, say, medicine, since we rarely see medical doctors serving hamburgers. I can thus infer that I can largely gauge the performance of the latter profession's entire population from what sample is visible to me. Likewise with plumbers, taxi drivers, prostitutes, and those in professions devoid of superstar effects. Let us go beyond the discussion on extremistan and mediocristan in Chapter 3. The consequence of the superstar dynamic is that what we call literary heritage or literary treasures is a minute proportion of what has been produced cumulatively. This is the first point. How it invalidates the identification of talent can be derived immediately from it. Say you attribute the success of the 19th century novelist Honoré de Balzac to his superior realism, insights, sensitivity, treatment of characters, ability to keep the reader riveted, and so on. These may be deemed superior qualities that lead to superior performance if, and only if, those who lack what we call talent also lack these qualities. But what if there are dozens of comparable literary masterpieces that happened to perish? And, following my logic, if there are indeed many perished manuscripts with similar attributes, then, I regret to say, your idol Balzac was just the beneficiary of disproportionate luck compared to his peers. Furthermore, you may be committing an injustice to others by favoring him. My point, I will repeat, is not that Balzac is untalented, but that he is less uniquely talented than we think. Just consider the thousands of writers now completely vanished from consciousness. Their record does not enter into analyses. We do not see the tons of rejected manuscripts because these writers have never been published. The New Yorker alone rejects close to 100 manuscripts a day, so imagine the number of geniuses that we will never hear about. In a country like France, where more people write books while, sadly, fewer people read them, respectable literary publishers accept 1 in 10,000 manuscripts they receive from first-time authors. Consider the number of actors who have never passed an audition but would have done very well had they had that lucky break in life. The next time you visit a Frenchman of comfortable means, you will likely spot the stern books from the collection Bibliothèque de la Pléiade, which their owner will never, almost never read, mostly on account of their uncomfortable size and weight. Membership in the Pléiade means membership in the literary canon. The tomes are expensive. They have the distinctive smell of ultra-thin India paper, compressing the equivalent of 1,500 pages into the size of a drugstore paperback. They are supposed to help you maximize the number of masterpieces per Parisian square foot. The publisher Gallimard has been extremely selective in electing writers into the Pléiade collection. Only a few authors, such as the aesthete and adventurer André Malraux, have made it in while still alive. Dickens, Dostoevsky, Hugo, and Stendhal are in, along with Mallarmé, Sartre, Camus, and Balzac. Yet if you follow Balzac's own ideas, which I will examine next, you would accept that there is no ultimate justification for such an official corpus. Balzac outlined the entire business of silent evidence in his novel Lost Illusions. Lucien de Rubempré, alias of Lucien Chardon, the penurious provincial genius, goes up to Paris to start a literary career. We are told that he is talented. Actually, he is told that he is talented by the semi-aristocratic set in Angoulême. But it is difficult to figure out whether this is due to his good looks or to the literary quality of his works, or even whether literary quality is visible or, as Balzac seems to wonder, if it has much to do with anything. Success is presented cynically, as the product of wile and promotion or the lucky surge of interest for reasons completely external to the works themselves. Lucien discovers the existence of the immense cemetery inhabited by what Balzac calls nightingales. Lucien was told that this designation, nightingale, was given by bookstores to those works residing on the shelves in the solitary depths of their shops. Balzac presents to us the sorry state of contemporary literature when Lucien's manuscript is rejected by a publisher who has never read it. Later on, when Lucien's reputation is developed, the very same manuscript is accepted by another publisher who did not read it either. The work itself was a secondary consideration. In another example of silent evidence, the book's characters keep bemoaning that things are no longer as they were before, implying that literary fairness prevailed in more ancient times, as if there was no cemetery before. They fail to take into account the nightingales among the ancients' work. Notice that close to two centuries ago, people had an idealized opinion of their own past, just as we have an idealized opinion of today's past. I mentioned earlier that to understand successes and analyze what caused them, we need to study the traits present in failures. It is to a more general version of this point that I turn next. How to Become a Millionaire in 10 Steps. Numerous studies of millionaires aimed at figuring out the skills required for hotshotness follow the following methodology. They take a population of hotshots, those with big titles and big jobs, and study their attributes. They look at what those big guns have in common, courage, risk-taking, optimism, and so on, and infer that these traits, most notably risk-taking, help you to become successful. You would also probably get the same impression if you read CEOs' ghost-written autobiographies or attended their presentations to fawning MBA students. Now take a look at the cemetery. It is quite difficult to do so because people who fail do not seem to write memoirs, and if they did, those business publishers I know would not even consider giving them the courtesy of a returned phone call. As to returned email, forget it. Readers would not pay $26.95 for a story of failure, even if you convinced them that it had more useful tricks than a story of success. Footnote. The best non-charlatanic finance book I know is called What I Learned Losing $1 Million by D. Paul and B. Moynihan. The authors had to self-publish the book. The entire notion of biography is grounded in the arbitrary ascription of a causal relation between specified traits and subsequent events. Now consider the cemetery. The graveyard of failed persons will be full of people who shared the following traits: courage, risk-taking, optimism, etc. Just like the population of millionaires. There may be some differences in skills, but what truly separates the two is for the most part a single factor. Luck. Plain luck. You do not need a lot of empiricism to figure this out. A simple thought experiment suffices. The fund management industry claims that some people are extremely skilled, since year after year they have outperformed the market. They will identify these geniuses and convince you of their abilities. My approach has been to manufacture cohorts of purely random investors and, by simple computer simulation, show how it would be impossible to not have these geniuses produced just by luck. Every year you fire the losers, leaving only the winners, and thus end up with long-term steady winners. Since you do not observe the cemetery of failed investors, you will think that it is a good business and that some operators are considerably better than others. Of course, an explanation will be readily provided for the success of the lucky survivors. He eats tofu. She works late. Just the other day I called her office at 8 p.m. Or, of course, she is naturally lazy. People with that type of laziness can see things clearly. By the mechanism of retrospective determinism, we will find the cause. Actually, we need to see the cause. I call these simulations of hypothetical cohorts, often done by computer, an engine of computational epistemology. Your thought experiments can be run on a computer. You just simulate an alternative world, plain random, and verify that it looks similar to the one in which we live. Not getting lucky billionaires in these experiments would be the exception. Footnote. Doctors are rightfully and vigorously skeptical of anecdotal results and require that studies of drug efficacy probe into the cemetery of silent evidence. However, the same doctors fall for the bias elsewhere. Where? In their personal lives or in their investment activities. At the cost of being repetitive, I have to once again state my amazement at the aspect of human nature that allows us to mix the most rigorous skepticism and the most acute gullibility. Recall the distinction between mediocristan and extremistan in Chapter 3. I said that taking a scalable profession is not a good idea, simply because there are far too few winners in these professions. Well, these professions produce a large cemetery. The pool of starving actors is larger than the one of starving accountants, even if you assume that, on average, they earn the same income. A health club for rats. The second and more vicious variety of the problem of silent evidence is as follows. When I was in my early 20s and still read the newspaper, and thought that steadily reading the newspapers was something useful to me, I came across an article discussing the mounting threat of the Russian mafia in the United States and its displacement of the traditional Louis and Tony in some neighborhoods of Brooklyn. The article explained their toughness and brutality as a result of their being hardened by their gulag experiences. The gulag was a network of labor camps in Siberia where criminals and dissidents were routinely deported. Sending people to Siberia was one of the purification methods initially used by the Tsarist regimes and later continued and perfected by the Soviets. Many deportees did not survive these labor camps. Hardened by the gulag, the sentence jumped out at me as both profoundly flawed and a reasonable inference. It took me a while to figure out the nonsense in it since it was protected by cosmetic wrapping. The following thought experiment will give the intuition. Assume that you're able to find a large, assorted population of rats. Fat, thin, sickly, strong, well-proportioned, etc. You can easily get them from the kitchens of fancy New York restaurants. With these thousands of rats, you build a heterogeneous cohort, one that is well representative of the general New York rat population. You bring them to my laboratory on East 59th Street in New York City, and we put the entire collection in a large vat. We subject the rats to increasingly higher levels of radiation. Since this is supposed to be a thought experiment, I am told that there is no cruelty in the process. At every level of radiation, those that are naturally stronger, and that is the key, will survive. The dead will drop out of your sample. We will progressively have a stronger and stronger collection of rats. Notice the following central fact. Every single rat, including the strong ones, will be weaker after the radiation than before. An observer endowed with analytical abilities, who probably got excellent grades in college, would be led to believe that treatment in my laboratory is an excellent health club replacement and one that could be generalized to all mammals. Think of the potential commercial success. His logic would run as follows. Hey, these rats are stronger than the rest of the rat population. What do they seem to have in common? They all came from that black swan guy, Taleb's workshop. Not many people will have the temptation to go look at the dead rats. Next, we pull the following trick on the New York Times. We let these surviving rats loose in New York City and inform the chief rodent correspondent of the newsworthy disruption in the pecking order in the New York rat population. He will write a lengthy and analytical article on the social dynamics of New York rats that includes the following passage. Those rats are now bullies in the rat population. They literally run the show, strengthened by their experience in the laboratory of the reclusive, but friendly, statistician, philosopher, trader, Dr. Taleb. They... Vicious bias. There is a vicious attribute to the bias. It can hide best when its impact is largest. Owing to the invisibility of the dead rats, the more lethal the risks, the less visible they will be, since the severely victimized are largely to be eliminated from the evidence. The more injurious the treatment, the larger the difference between the surviving rats and the rest, and the more fooled you will be about the strengthening effect. One of the two following ingredients is necessary for this difference between the true effect, weakening, and the observed one, strengthening. A. A degree of inequality in strength, or diversity, in the base cohort, or B, unevenness or diversity somewhere in the treatment. Diversity here has to do with the degree of uncertainty inherent in the process. More hidden applications. We can keep going with this argument. It has such universality that once we get the bug, it is hard to look at reality with the same eyes again. Clearly, it robs our observations of their realistic power. I will enumerate a few more cases to illustrate the weaknesses of our inferential machinery. The stability of species. Take the number of species that we now consider extinct. For a long time, scientists took the number of such species as that implied from an analysis of the extant fossils. But this number ignores the silent cemetery of species that came and left without leaving traces in the form of fossils. The fossils that we have managed to find correspond to a smaller proportion of all species that came and disappeared. This implies that our biodiversity was far greater than it seemed at first examination. A more worrisome consequence is that the rate of extinction of species may be far greater than we think. Close to 99.5% of species that transited through Earth are now extinct, a number that scientists have kept raising through time. Life is a great deal more fragile than we have allowed for. But this does not mean we humans should feel guilty for extinctions around us, nor does it mean that we should act to stop them. Species were coming and going before we started messing up the environment. There is no need to feel moral responsibility for every endangered species. Does crime pay? Newspapers report on the criminals who get caught. There is no section in the New York Times recording the stories of those who committed crimes but have not been caught. So it is with cases of tax evasion, government bribes, prostitution rings, poisoning of wealthy spouses with substances that do not have a name and cannot be detected, and drug trafficking. In addition, our representation of the standard criminal might be based on the properties of those less intelligent ones who were caught. Once we seep ourselves into the notion of silent evidence, so many things around us that were previously hidden start manifesting themselves. Having spent a couple of decades in this mindset, I am convinced, but cannot prove, that training and education can help us avoid its pitfalls. The evolution of the swimmer's body. What do the popular expressions "a swimmer's body" and "beginner's luck" have in common? What do they seem to share with the concept of history? There is a belief among gamblers that beginners are almost always lucky. It gets worse later, but gamblers are always lucky when they start out, you hear. This statement is actually empirically true. Researchers confirm that gamblers have lucky beginnings. The same applies to stock market speculators. Does this mean that each one of us should become a gambler for a while, take advantage of Lady Luck's friendliness to beginners, then stop? The answer is no. The same optical illusion prevails. Those who start gambling will be either lucky or unlucky. Given that the casino has the advantage, a slightly greater number will be unlucky. The lucky ones, with the feeling of having been selected by destiny, will continue gambling. The others, discouraged, will stop and will not show up in the sample. They will probably take up, depending on their temperaments, birdwatching, Scrabble, piracy, or other pastimes. Those who continue gambling will remember having been lucky as beginners. The dropouts by